Chicago Public Radio. This is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. In human beings, sex is determined by a pair of chromosomes, the X and the Y. Generally speaking, if you have two X's, you're a female. If you have an X and a Y, you're a male. For a long time, biologists thought that the Y chromosome was basically empty, except for the genes that determine maleness. But a recent study has located some other important genes on the Y chromosome and found that the Y employs some unusual methods for keeping its genetic material in good working order. The findings were quite a surprise in themselves. What can they add to our understanding of evolutionary processes? Today on Odyssey, we're going to talk about what we can learn from the Y chromosome. Joining us for the conversation is genomics researcher Steve Rosen. He's in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he is one of the authors of a recent article in the journal Science on the Y chromosome. Joining us from Berkeley, California, is Tom Klein, who is a geneticist. Tom Klein, your specialty is sex differentiation. So remind us, if you would, what it is that X and Y chromosomes do in humans.
Well, one of the amazing things about sex that attracted me to the subject is the huge variety of ways that sex is determined, male and female. And in humans, the way humans do it is there's a gene on the Y chromosome that males carry, that they also carry an X, and their sperm then, they produce, half their sperm doesn't carry a Y chromosome, and half carries the Y chromosome with this masculinizing gene. And so sex is determined by whether you get the masculinizing gene on your Y in the next generation or not. And so you get half males and half females as a consequence. But there are many different ways of doing it.
Well, so how does it actually do it? What does the gene do?
Well, the gene itself basically just controls other genes. So it's a whole cascade that goes down to transmit the signal eventually to the genes that determine how males and females are different. But the genes that are actually responsible for the differences are generally a long way in terms of gene regulation from the original trigger. And in fact, that's the way you should think of the masculinizing gene. It's basically just the trigger. And then everything else happens as a consequence, and different organisms have different triggers.
Okay. So Steve Rosen, other than this gene on the Y chromosome that determines maleness, for a long time, biologists thought that was pretty much all that was going on the Y. Otherwise, it was empty and useless. But you've been looking at the Y and found some interesting things.
That's right. So many years we thought that the Y chromosome was basically empty except for this masculinizing gene. But now for the first time we have the sequence of the Y chromosome in any species, and it's led to some really unexpected findings. One is that many of the genes on this chromosome occur in mirror image pairs, and we think that this strategy is a strategy to avoid decay by swapping genetic information between the two copies of the gene. And these genes are all genes necessary for sperm production, as it turns out.
So you have genes that normally, in any other chromosome pair, your genes on one chromosome would swap with genes on the other one. But you're saying on the Y, they swap within the same chromosome.
That's right. Not all of them, but a vast majority of them do.
Okay, we're going to talk some more about that, but anything else we should know about your research, about new information about what's going on the Y?
Well, we found that it has a fair number of genes. It's still a somewhat rotten chromosome. It has about 78 protein-coding genes, and of those, about 60 look like they're involved in sperm production.
I guess maybe we should say something about what we mean by rotten chromosome.
Sure, why don't you, Tom?
less males feel it. Well, that's one of the neat things about the Y chromosome. It gives you an opportunity to see how genes devolve as well as evolve, because one of the points is that I said that the Y chromosome carries a masculinizing gene that makes males males. But you don't need a Y chromosome to do that. You can have a masculinizing gene just on a normal chromosome, but the Y chromosome is special. It's a chromosome that's become isolated from its partner, the X, and as a consequence of that genetic isolation, it has lost genes over the 300 million years that it's existed.
Okay, let's walk through this really carefully. So the Y chromosome can't pair up with its X partner and swap genes. It's on its own in terms of what's on there.
Yeah, and that causes problems. As a consequence, if it loses a gene or has a damaged gene, it really has no way to get that normal gene back. Whereas if you're on another chromosome, you just exchange the bad one for a good one on another chromosome, and you're back in business.
So Steve Rosen, this swapping within the chromosome that you found actually suggests that the Y has come up with a way to make up for the fact that it can't do the swapping.
That's exactly right. So it looks like these genes have lucked out into a way of exchanging genetic material with a mirror copy of themselves on the same chromosome, as opposed to the normal way it's done, which is by exchanging information with another chromosome that's a nearly identical pair.
So overall, Steve Rosen, would you say that the Y chromosome still, it has deteriorated and it's lost a lot of genes?
Oh, yes, it's lost many genes. So the X has well over 1,000 genes, and the Y chromosome, as I said, has about 78 genes. The X is bigger, but it's not that much bigger. So the Y definitely is degenerated compared to the X chromosome.
So,
but that's not the whole story. Yeah.
Oh, we'll tell more of the story. But
well, the other story is this: these genes that are involved in sperm production, many of them have come from elsewhere in the genome over evolutionary time. And once they show up on the Y chromosome, they look like they find this mirror image organization, this palindrome organization that lets them survive.
So
on that chromosome.
They've migrated onto the Y from other places?
That's right, yes.
We're talking today about Y chromosomes and some recent research that finds them to be more complex and interesting than was previously thought, perhaps in ways that might be relevant for larger understandings of genetic processes and even of evolution. We're joined for a conversation by Steve Rosen, who is one of the researchers who worked on the project, and we're talking with Tom Klein, who is a geneticist. Okay. So many interesting things. Let's pick at a few of them and learn a little bit more. If a Y chromosome can't swap genes, can't get rid of any, can't swap any, that means that it must be the same from one generation to the next. Is that right, Tom Klein?
Well, no. That's actually the problem. It would be the same in the absence of mutations. But the point is, nothing is static in nature, and so gene sequence changes, and generally it changes for the worse. And so this is the problem: that you begin get you delete genes, you have mutations in the middle of genes that keep them from doing their jobs. So you accumulate deleterious mutations, and that's why, in fact, you lose gene functions on the Y chromosome. And in fact, you have to develop a whole new system of gene regulation to respond to that loss called dosis compensation, but we don't need to perhaps get into that. But no, nothing stays the same in nature. That's sort of a rule.
Okay, but I guess what I'm wondering is, if there's a gene on the Y chromosome, even if it goes inactive or deteriorates or whatever, is there a trace left on it? I mean, can you sort of see the history of the Y chromosome on it?
Well, it depends on how long ago it was lost.
Okay, we have a little difference of opinion here.
That's amazing.
No, I agree with Tom. It depends on how long it was lost, but we see many cases where the carcasses of formerly intact genes are clearly visible on the Y chromosome of humans.
Is that a useful thing to be able to see, Steve Rosen?
For exactly the same reason that Tom talked about. It lets us look at the process of gene decay, so we get snapshots into the process of gene decay.
In fact, just a little bit of an editorial comment. I say those that are concerned about the validity of evolution, they'd have a hard time explaining the devolution of genes in terms of alternative hypotheses.
So Y chromosomes, even though it's not full of active working genes, it's actually full of all kinds of... it's a good source of information about how things work and how the system is organized, why it's organized that way. Tom Klein.
Absolutely. And there are all sorts of reasons it's interesting. I mean, one of the most curious things about it is that it's only ever present in males, and it's always passed then from father to son. So its lineage, it's sort of like the mitochondria in terms of genealogies that way. Mitochondria always pass from mother to progeny. The Y chromosome only ever goes through the males. And as a consequence, you can trace ancestry. You can trace your paternal ancestry and your maternal ancestry separately. And in fact, the new discoveries of sequencing of the Y chromosome gives us enormously better tools for actually being able to trace ancestry of Y chromosomes over time. And that's a whole business in itself.
You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio, and we're talking today on the program about the Y chromosome. There's recently been some research published about interesting things going on the Y chromosome, and we're joined by Tom Klein, a geneticist, and Steve Rosen, who is one of the researchers. Steve Rosen, let's come back to this, the palindromes, the self-replication on the Y chromosome. First of all, tell me again what's going on there.
Okay, so it turns out that a huge part of the genes on the Y chromosome are found in these mirror image pairs and these palindromes, so sequences that read the same forward and backward. And we think that this is a mechanism that allows these genes many of which look like they're essential for sperm production, to resist decay. Ordinarily on a Y chromosome, if you get a mutation, a damage to a gene, then every Y chromosome descended from that Y chromosome must bear that damage until that lineage dies out. But this mirror imaging of these apparently essential genes offers the chance for them to repair themselves if they sustain damage.
So let's talk a little bit, besides damage repair, why would a species, or why would evolution produce recombination in the first place? Tom Klein, I mean, what's good about having chromosomes get together and swap genes?
Oh, that's a whole aspect of evolutionary biology addressing just that question. People have been struggling for years. The current thinking is that part of it is to reassort good combinations of genes. Basically, if you have a damaged gene, to basically get rid of it. But the other thing is simply to make new combinations of genes. You want to mix and match everything at a high frequency. And the main feeling is the reason you want to make all these new assortments of genes, that is why break up winning combinations. If you're successful and you have a good combination of genes, why not just go with that? The problem is we're always in a constant race with our parasites. And they're trying to take advantage of us. We're trying to avoid being taken advantage of. And so the current thinking is the big advantage of switching these genes all the time is so that basically we can stay a step ahead of our parasites.
Well, then, if that's a good thing, if the ability for chromosomes to swap genes is a good thing, it keeps us ahead of our parasites, why would evolution produce a pair of chromosomes that can't swap? I mean, why come up with a Y chromosome in the first place? Steve Rosen?
Well, evolution gets trapped because evolution can't look ahead. It just goes for the immediate win, and sometimes that causes itself to get painted into a corner, and that's exactly what happens, we think, on Y chromosomes.
Well, tell me what the immediate win is of a Y chromosome.
Well, the immediate win is that once you have so we think that Y and X evolved from an ordinary pair of chromosomes maybe a couple of hundred million years ago. And that at one point there were two variants of a gene on this pair of chromosomes, and one variant caused that creature to develop as a male. Once that happens, then there are many other genes that are good in males and bad in females, and there's an advantage to keeping those always on the same chromosome as the variant that produces the male. And that means that then evolution says, let's keep these good versions for males all together. Let's not recombine to do that.
Is there a name for
that? And then you're trapped. Pardon me?
Is there a name for that? Keeping all the male genes together?
Well, it's a response to something called sexual antagonism. So the concept that genes could come in varieties, two varieties. One variety is good in males, one's good in females.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk some more about the Y chromosome. And we're actually going to come back to that question of the immediate win for evolution. In other words, why would evolution want to divide a perfectly good organism into males and females in the first place? We'll talk about what that yields and a lot of other things about this new research into Y chromosomes. Stay with us. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you are listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio.
Thank you.
You are listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Today on the program, we're talking about the Y chromosome, the chromosome which in humans determines sex. And we're talking about some recent research into the Y chromosome, what's going on it, some of the interesting things that folks have found. We're joined for our conversation by Steve Rosen. Rosen is a researcher at the Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Research at MIT in Cambridge. Steve Rosen co-directs several research projects on the Y chromosome, and he's joining us today from the campus of MIT. With us in Berkeley, California, is Tom Klein, who is a geneticist at the University of California, Berkeley. He researches sex determination. Tom Klein, earlier in the program, we were talking about the benefits of recombination, which is one of the things that, one of the benefits that we get by having sexual reproduction. In other words, you get chromosomes from your mother, some from your father, they mix, you get new things. Okay, great. Why have males and females, though? What good is that?
Well, that's really a fundamental question in biology, because you don't need males and females to mix genes. You just need to mix genes, and you can have the two parents being exactly equal. But what you find in almost every single higher organism is you do have two sexes, males and females. And the difference is one sex makes an egg and one sex makes a sperm. What does that mean? It means basically it's a division of labor, that one sex makes a much bigger investment in the offspring than the other. So it takes a lot more to make an egg, and especially if you carry that egg around and develop it as a fetus for 9 months, you're making a huge investment in it, and then that continues after birth, even for humans. Whereas the males make tons and tons of sperm, and their job is to sort of spread the genes around. So it's basically a division of labor. And then the question is, well, how do you divide the labor, and how many of each kind of laborers do you have? And it turns out that in many cases, maybe most but maybe not, we don't really know for sure, you end up with a one-to-one mix of males and females. And then the question is, well, why one-to-one? And that turns out that, that Charles Darwin himself answered, but then he got cold feet and withdrew his answer, and then R.A. Fisher, many, many years later, gave the answer again, which is if you don't have a one-to-one sex ratio, the minority sex has an advantage in terms of passing genes on to the next generation. If there are fewer males, it takes a male and a female to make an offspring. Well, if there are fewer males in the population, he runs around, he makes more offspring, he passes on more genes, and so it benefits that individual to produce more of that minority offspring. Well, that goes on until it's sort of a truce is reached where you have a one-to-one sex ratio, so it's in nobody's advantage to change that sex ratio. And so the Y chromosome in humans, the way humans do it, and it's not the only way, I work on fruit flies, they do it a very different way. They have a Y chromosome, but that's not what determines sex. But the bottom line is that both for fruit flies and humans, we have approximately equal numbers of males and females because of the way genes control sex.
Okay, I think I get it. So is that to say that by keeping, does that have to do with keeping the Y chromosome separate? In other words, not letting it mix with the X? Would it not Y if it could mix with the X? It could mix with the X.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, what's important to realize is a lot of organisms don't have a Y chromosome, and moreover, there are mammals even that have lost their Y chromosome, that no longer use this dominant masculinizing gene on the Y chromosome. So you don't have to have a Y chromosome. That's just one strategy. And what happens if you have a dominant masculinizing gene that makes males males on a chromosome, that then gives the opportunity to develop a Y chromosome. And in fact, that's what's happened then in the mammalian lineage. But so, there's a whole variety of different ways to do it.
Well, I want to come back and talk about some of those. But Steve Rosen, let me ask you a question first. In the absence of this process that you and your team discovered, where the Y chromosome can use these palindromic sequences and make corrections and do its own repair within itself, Is it reasonable to hypothesize that in the absence of that process, the Y chromosome in humans could have disappeared?
Well, it's a hard question to answer because it's a what if, and evolution is pretty random. Most mammals do have X's and Y's, and only a few rodents have lost the Y. So that's a pretty speculative question. I think it's clear though that if you have these genes that are necessary to produce sperm, and you can repair them, then those Ys have an edge. They have an advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they're still here. Yeah.
Okay. Tom Klein, let's talk about some of the other ways that there are for determining sex. Let's say you didn't have a Y chromosome, or let's say your Y chromosome didn't have the sex-determining gene on it. What's some of the range of possibilities out there?
Well, let's just, for example, take the organism I work with, which is the fruit fly, which a lot's known about, and its genome's been sequenced. In the fruit fly, it's the number of X chromosomes that determines your sex. So if you have two and you're a diploid animal, you're female. If you have one, you're male. And yet there is a Y chromosome, and the purpose the Y chromosome serves, lo and behold, is the same thing it does in humans to some extent, which is it carries a bunch of genes that are specifically involved in spermatogenesis, where it's probably
making sperm.
Advantageous in making sperm, yes.
Okay.
So it's probably advantageous to keep those genes in the sex where their relevance is constantly tested and where they can do things that if they did them in females might be deleterious. Although that's sort of an interesting question because, well, I won't get into that. But the point is it has a Y chromosome, it has male-specific genes that are specifically involved in making sperm and they're selected, but it doesn't determine sex. And the point I'm making about the voles that lose their Y chromosome is only that sex determination mechanisms can change very rapidly and very dramatically, so that and they may have to for organisms to get themselves out of various binds that they get themselves into. So the fact that you can lose a Y chromosome in a mammalian lineage means, well, it can happen, and you can come up with an alternative pretty quickly if you'd absolutely have to.
Steve Rosen, are there any implications from this? Okay, if this is the way that humans do it, we have this Y chromosome and there's stuff on it that has to do with sex determination and other processes that men rely on, obviously. Are there any other implications from this particular arrangement of things for differences in human beings between men and women?
Are there differences in the genes that we find on the Y chromosome?
Does your research point to what you find? Does it point to any explaining any other differences between men and women?
Well, that's a big question, and many people would like to find such differences, many researchers, because that'd be very novel. The dogma is that differences between men and women are mostly due to sex hormones, testosterone. So SRY. The masculinizing gene on the Y chromosome turns on a cascade that then starts with production of testosterone. The testosterone is then probably responsible for most of the things that make men and women different. That said, there are genes on the Y chromosome that don't look like they're sperm production genes. There are three genes that are generated or active in the brain. And only in a few other places, and it's conceivable, speculatively, that those could make some difference between the way brains and men and women are organized. But that's all very, very tentative speculation at this point.
Okay, but go ahead, Tom Klein.
Well, I might just point out, too, that along with that is the fact that if you look at what are called Y-linked traits, as you try to find genetic differences where the information for that difference tracks with the Y chromosome, to date, really the only genetic differences that track with the Y chromosome are differences involved in fertility or actual sexual development. So, for example, if there was some big difference between males or between males and females, you might expect to see that difference genetically mapped to the Y chromosome. People have certainly looked for all sorts of characters mapping to the Y chromosome. But as I said, the only ones that I know about that have been found are things involved in actual the primary event of determining maleness. Or
that's right, yes.
Things involved in sperm production.
Okay. Right. So, Steve Rosen, you're suggesting that these few genes that look like they're active in the brain, that might be a place to look to see if the Y chromosome is actually responsible for differences that aren't related just primarily to the event of becoming male instead of female.
To hormones, right. Yeah.
Okay.
The problem is that the hormones are so overwhelming that it's hard to see the signal from anything else.
Okay. Now, I'm sure a lot of people get really antsy about that sort of a proposal, as they often do when people talk about sex differences. Tom Klein, hang on one second, because I want to give listeners our number, because we're going to take some calls a little later in the program. Our phone number, which is toll-free, is 1-888-859-1800. We're talking today about the Y chromosome and some recent research into the Y, how it is organized and how it operates. We're joined by Steve Rosen, who is one of the researchers. He's at the Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Research at MIT, and he co-directs several projects on the Y chromosome. He's joining us from MIT today. With us in Berkeley, California, is Tom Klein. Klein is a geneticist who works on sex determination. Okay, Tom Klein, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out, well, I mean, one of the nice things about what are called the model genetic organisms, like nematodes and flies and so forth, is you really can work through the genetic pathways quite a bit easier than in humans, although humans are not so bad these days. But the point I want to make is that there are genes that control, for example, sexual behavior. There's a gene called Fruitless in Drosophila, which really is responsible for male-specific behaviors, but it's not on the Y chromosome. Even though flies have a Y chromosome, it's specifically involved in spermatogenesis. Genes that actually control aspects of sexual development, sexual dimorphism, in fact, major genes that control the difference between males and females, are not on the Y chromosome. So that tells us that there's no particular reason to think the human Y chromosome is going to contain a whole bunch of genes involved in other aspects of sexual differences.
Well, so that's sort of weird, if I may put it in layman's terms, because certainly when you take biology from, you know, when you're not planning to be a biologist, you sort of get this idea that you have all these pairs of chromosomes, and then you have X and Y, and that takes care of the sex stuff. But what you're actually suggesting is that the Y chromosome is a unique location in the genome for all kinds of good reasons, but the whole process of sex differentiation and other related things related to sexual reproduction might be spread throughout the genome.
Well, perhaps related to that is the fact, something I alluded to very early, that there's all sorts of different mechanisms for triggering who will become male and who will become female and what the ratio is between males and females. And what the Y chromosome and the male determining gene on that is basically this trigger. But that we've had sexes, males and females, for a long time that actually predate the specific mechanism that either humans or fruit flies use for determining who's male and who's female. So it's not surprising that the genes involved in actually making males and females different in terms of their development would not be on the sex chromosomes, because they probably evolved long, in fact, we know they evolved long before the specific triggers that now determine male and female.
So given the variety of ways in which organisms can produce two sexes, in other words, produce males and females, does that mean that the natural world has come up with this idea in lots of different times?
Oh, absolutely, and in lots of different ways. And as I said, it can change quickly. And it's something that has to change. We work on a parasite that is notorious in arthropods, fortunately it doesn't affect mammals, the parasite will affect sex. And so the organism then has to respond to that. I said a lot of our
evolution
has to do with...
Wait, how does that work?
Oh, well, it's a parasite that has to live inside the cells, and it's a bacterium, and it's only transmitted from mother to the progeny. So it actually tries to increase the number of mothers to increase its transmission. It doesn't care much about fathers, and in fact, in many cases, it kills the males or changes males into females or does all sorts of crazy things to various species. And we recently discovered that it actually has some effects in the fruit fly as well that will allow us to study it. But there's all sorts of weirdness out there in terms of interactions between organisms that have to do with sex. And that's probably why there's so many different ways of determining sex.
So, Tom Klein, let me ask you, what do you think are, based on the most recent research, but other questions that are being asked about the Y chromosome, what are the sort of next questions? What can we learn from this research? What are the sort of big evolutionary questions that the Y chromosome can tell us or help us to get at?
There's all sorts of things. The Y chromosome shows us how genes deteriorate. The Y chromosomes show us how new gene functions arise. And the Y chromosome shows us how genes correct themselves. This idea of gene conversion, the thing that's going on with the Y chromosome, there's no reason to think that the same kind of thing can't go on other chromosomes. It's just that it's easier to detect and discover it by working with this Y chromosome because of other special aspects about it that make it harder to study in some ways, but easier to find the sorts of things that are now being found out. And in terms of evolution, as I said, it allows tracing the line of descent from the fathers, and it's actually being used more and more now even in human genealogy to actually look at relationships between different populations of people. So it's basically good for almost everything, as far as I can tell. And also the evolutionary questions about how, you know, sexual antagonism, a male-male competition, how do genes respond to that?
Let me give our number once again. It's 1-888-859-1800. Again, it's toll-free anywhere in the U.S., so give us a call. If you'd like to ask a question, make a comment, join in the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. You are listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Steve Rosen, what are the next questions for you? I mean, you're doing Y chromosome research. What do you want to know next?
Well, one thing is that, as Tom alluded to, the Y is a great chromosome as a laboratory to see what happens if you do away with sexual crossing over, sexual recombination, swapping between chromosome pairs. And so it'd be interesting to look at Y chromosomes in other mammals and other species to see what we can learn about this process of decay in the absence of swapping genetic information with a partner chromosome. We're also very interested in the aspect of male infertility. We know that deletions of small pieces of the Y chromosome in humans cause a fair proportion of human male infertility. In fact, it's the major genetic cause that we know of in human male infertility. And so we're continuing to look for specific damage to specific genes in men that don't produce sperm well or at all.
Let me ask you a question about other mammals, because I'm just wondering, you know, how old is the system that exists in humans? In other words, how much would you expect that the human XY regime, if I can put it that way, has in common with other mammals, particularly mammals that are closely related to humans?
Right. So, well, the general scheme is nearly universal among mammals. Tom mentioned a few exceptions, but the specifics of the Y chromosome look like they vary quite a bit. So we know that if you look at the chimpanzee Y chromosome, which we've done a little bit, we did a little bit in this research, many of the same genes are on the chimpanzee Y chromosome as the human Y chromosome. Many of the major themes are similar. There are these mirror images that are self-correcting. When we look further away at the mouse, we still see that there are many genes involved in sperm production, but it's clear that the actual specifics of that trajectory over evolution have been rather different.
Why I think that is interesting, I'll tell you why I think it's interesting, because it seems like the male-female difference in mammals seems like such a fundamental feature of mammals, and it sort of surprises me that it wouldn't be fixed in evolutionary terms at some point much further back. I'm surprised by how volatile it is, I guess is what I would say. Is it actually volatile, Steve Rosen?
Oh, yes, and Tom has alluded to this earlier. It's very volatile, and I think it's a big question about why it's volatile. So the triggering mechanism is often very volatile. So among land-dwelling vertebrates, you have sex determined by the temperature at which an egg is incubated in the case of some turtles and alligators. You have, in the case of birds, you have the reverse situation where a rooster has, so to speak, two X chromosomes, and the hen has an X and a Y. They call them the Z and the W, but it's the same idea, only inverted. And then you have some lizards that have different arrangements also. So there's a great deal of variety. It looks like downstream of that first triggering mechanism, there might be a fair amount of conservation. I don't know if Tom sees this kind of thing in insects.
Tom Klein, just quickly, we have to take a break, but if you could just comment quickly.
You have to go actually fairly far down to get the real conservation. But in fact, one of the amazing things about these genes is even the male determining gene in humans, it's one of the most varying genes in the genome. That is, it changes more rapidly. And the question is why? Well, but then the question becomes, why are species different anyway? How do you get different species? And one feeling is that maybe incompatibilities in the sex determining systems, as changes in the way the sex is determined, could represent what's called a barrier between two groups of individuals that would then give rise to two separate species, which are basically populations that don't interbreed.
Because Tom Klein, we've got to stop there. We've got to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk some more and take some phone calls at 1-888-859-1800. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Welcome back to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. On today's program, we've been talking about the Y chromosome. Why the Y? Because there's some new research that shows that the Y is a more complicated chromosome than was previously believed, and that it takes care of its business, keeps its genetic house in order in some very interesting ways. We've been talking with one of the researchers on that project, Steve Rosen, from the Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Research at MIT. We've also been talking with Tom Klein, a geneticist at the University of California, Berkeley. We're going to take some calls now. Let's talk with Larry. Hello, Larry. You're on Odyssey.
Hi, Gretchen. Thanks for taking my call. My question was is about the that effect where the Y chromosome has a palindrome. I don't know what you call them. They're like palindromes on it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that effect replicated in other primates like chimpanzees and apes or other simians? If it is, does that say anything about evolution?
Steve Rosen, I think you were just saying you did find it in chimps, didn't you?
Yes, we did. And we have hints that some of them that are the same as in human are in gorilla as well.
Now, can I ask a question? Did you find that you found that on Y chromosomes in chimps?
That's right.
And you were both saying, you and Tom were both saying earlier that it quite possibly may be happening on other chromosomes as well, but just is less visible because those chromosomes have so much going on. Did I understand
that right? That's right.
So what does that mean if that process is out there in a somewhat widespread way?
Well, it means that the way that genomes change could be more dynamic than we thought. So it's another way that genomes could change. We thought before that, well, genomes change primarily by the steady and slow accumulation of small changes, most of them bad, a few of them good. But here we have the possibility that sometimes they might change in a big gene conversion event that might change things a lot.
And what do you mean, a gene conversion event?
Well, one of these sort of copies where what happens in the palindromes on the Y is basically one copy of the gene can overwrite its mirror image, and that's the mechanism by which it could correct damage to one of the two copies. And so that could happen in other parts of the genome too, where with much higher frequency than we thought, one piece of the genome could overwrite another similar piece of the genome.
So in a sense, it's conservative, if we can use that word, to mean it keeps things that are good, hangs on to things that are good, fixes them up.
Well, we think it may be actually a little more complicated than that. We think that it may not actually know which is the good copy, but it may be that evolution sorts it out. So it may be that sometimes it actually takes the bad copy and wrecks the good copy.
I'm so glad you said that, because I've always wondered how it knew which one is the good copy. So maybe it doesn't know.
It maybe doesn't, right?
It can't. Well, actually, Steve, you did
depends on when. Depends on how soon
after.
Yeah.
the correction tends to be more in favor of the normal sequence than the change sequence, and I was a little bit puzzled how you could explain that. If you look at the way the changes happen in the course of looking here within humans, I was a little bit amazed by that.
How can you explain it?
Well, there's lots of possible explanations. One possibility is that gene conversion, this overwriting process, can be biased at a biochemical level, so that it prefers one version over the other. So that's one possibility.
Okay. That's enough for today's show, I think.
One comment.
Tom Klein.
I think one comment about our caller. Our caller was interested in the evolutionary question. And I guess what struck me looking at these articles, amazing articles on the human Y chromosome, was that in fact the human Y chromosome is not qualitatively different from the chimpanzee Y chromosomes or other Y chromosomes in mammals. It's different, but there's no real qualitative difference. It's not like it's doing something that the chimps aren't doing.
And that's new?
Yes.
You didn't know that? Tom Klein?
Well, this is the way you find it out. You actually gather all the information. What does the human Y chromosome look like? What do the chimp Y chromosomes look like? What do fruit fly Y chromosomes look like? And you want to go all that far. That you need to get that information to know just how similar, and the more information we get, the more similar we're finding that we all are.
All right, let's take another call. Let's talk with Mike. Hello, Mike, you're on Odyssey.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering, in birds, the female has a chromosome that is not present in the male. Does that chromosome have genes that are involved in egg making, and does that chromosome have palindromic sequences?
Well, the answer to the second question is we don't know if it has palindromes, and I'd love to find out. And there's a plan afoot to sequence the chicken genome, and that'd be a good question to ask. And actually, I'm going to say, I guess it has genes involved in egg production, but I don't have firsthand experience with that. I don't know if Tom does.
Well, no, and in fact, if you ask the basic question, is it the number of Z chromosomes in the chicken or the Y or the W chromosome that determines sex? I don't think even the definitive answer is in on that simple point.
That's my understanding.
It's not easy to get this information. You've got to fiddle with the system. You've got to look at you have to look at triploid chickens and all sorts of aberrant chickens to make a guess.
Yeah.
As I said, the human and fruit fly basic system looks identical, and yet the mechanism is completely unrelated. The way they determine sex.
Hmm. All right, let's take some
good
more
question. Yeah.
Let's take some more calls. Our number is 1-888-859-1800. Let's talk with Yared. Hello, Yared. You're on Odyssey.
Thanks for taking my call, Gretchen. My question to the researchers is what implications their work has with people who are transgendered. And I mean, when I say transgendered, it's an umbrella term, so it could be anybody from a crossdresser to someone who wants to change their sex to someone with a slight feminine tendency for male or the opposite for female. And maybe perhaps that is why we have millions and millions of people that don't necessarily fit into the male-female dichotomy. And I feel like a lot of our conversation is dealing with this issue in a dichotomic sense. I'll take my answers off air.
Okay, thanks for your call. Steve Rosen.
Well, I think a lot goes into determining our gender, so how we perceive ourselves as male and female. And as Yara sort of implied, that's somewhat governed by our experiences, maybe by things that happen to us as we're in the womb, as we grow up, that we don't know about right now. So certainly there are cases where people have a Y chromosome, but this masculinizing gene is mutated to the point that it doesn't work, and they grow up as almost completely normal females. I think that this is consistent with sort of something of a continuum about people's sense of their own gender.
Tom Klein.
Yeah,
please go ahead.
Well, yeah, I would say that scientists take the safe route. Your question is a good question about how you identify male and female and intersexes, intersexuality, all this. But if you basically define sex as who makes eggs and who makes sperm, it becomes very simple. And then, as Steve alluded to, there are some what are called XY females. But interestingly enough, they can't make eggs. And so what does that mean? Well, it simply means they're not what's called the wild type. That is, something has happened that's not normal. I mean, they're not able to reproduce. There's nothing bad about that, but the point is it's a change. But in terms of defining maleness and femaleness, we normally define that in terms of the normal situation. And as soon as you start getting into the minority genetically abnormal situation, and certainly the inability to reproduce is a genetic abnormality any way you look at it, then things get ambiguous. And I don't think how you define things in those situations, and in fact the way you respond in terms of medicine, is basically way out of either Steve or my purview in terms of what we would contribute. I think we can have our opinions, but I don't think the Y chromosome research at this point is going to have much to say about those kinds of situations.
All right,
let's
take some more calls. Our number again, 1-888-859-1800. Let's take a call from Dean. Hello, Dean, you're on Odyssey.
Hello, yes, I was wondering, has there been any research done, as there has with mitochondria DNA, for tracing back the original fathers? I think it's like a dozen or so women are thought to have passed on their mitochondrial DNA, and everyone can be traced back to one of these hypothetical women. Is there anything
comparable
discovered
for
like
men?
For men along those lines?
Steve Rosen?
Yes, there certainly is, and we think that our Y chromosomes all descend from a single Y chromosome that was in a man. We think he was in Africa somewhere between 50 and 150,000 years ago. Now, he wasn't the only man alive at that point, but he's the only man alive at that point who's connected to the present by an unbroken line of sons.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's an important distinction. That's why we talk about the hypothetical Eve and the hypothetical Adam, because it looks that way, and that's statistically the way it has to work out. But that doesn't, as Steve said, it doesn't mean there was one Adam and one Eve, and they gave rise to all humans.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio, and we're talking today about the Y chromosome, some recent research, some interesting findings about how the Y is organized and the kinds of things that it does. Let's take another call. Our number, 1-888-859-1800. Let's talk with Carrie. Hello, Carrie. You're on Odyssey.
Hi. I was wondering if you could discuss the difference between individuals that are XY and XYY, and if it's advantageous to have chromosomes in a pair, why we don't see more XYY individuals.
Steve Rosen.
Okay, that sounds like one for me. Well, there was some thought for a time that people who were XYY might be hyper-masculinized. Though this isn't my particular area, I think that there's no evidence at this point that that's the case. Then the question is, wouldn't it be better to be XYY, because then the Y would have a partner and could repair the problems that it has, these mutations. The problem is that the cell isn't necessarily designed to sort out three chromosomes. It's really designed to sort out pairs of chromosomes. And in fact, the way the cell gets around this problem in an ordinary case of an XY male is it sorts out the X to one sperm and the Y to the other sperm. When you have XYY, the cell doesn't do as well at sorting that out. And what happens is that extra Y tends to get lost.
What do you mean lost?
Well, it doesn't make it into the sperm very often.
Okay.
So it doesn't tend to get transmitted.
Okay, Tom Klein?
I suspect the sex ratio is probably altered a bit. I don't really know for sure what happens in those situations, but I suspect it skews the sex ratio, and as I said, any deviation from 1-to-1 causes pressure to get it back to 1-to-1, at least in humans. So right. It's an abnormal situation. It's not the normal, or it's a very minority situation that has somewhat adverse consequences.
In our last few minutes, I'd like to talk a little bit about where you see this research, or help us to understand where this research fits into the overall project of mapping the human genome. Because as I understood it, when the Human Genome Project was undertaken, it was a female genome that was mapped, including an X, and not a Y. But perhaps I've misunderstood. So, Steve Rosen, can you tell us where this fits into that project, where your research fits into that project?
Well, our research is actually part of the Human Genome Project. And we've been working on it for many, many years. Our lab started trying to do the coarsest mapping way back in the early 90s. And it's a great relief, actually, to get one of these Y chromosomes done at this point. And we've been supported by the NIH and the National Human Genome Research Institute through all that effort.
And the Y was harder to map than other chromosomes, is that right?
It was, though we were also, because of these highly similar copies. So it's like having a puzzle where there's two parts of the puzzle that have basically the same picture, and you can't figure out which versions of the picture the piece goes in. But it also forced us to deal with some of these problems that exist to some level on other chromosomes. It really rubbed our nose in it. We had no choice. At first, we thought maybe these highly repeated, duplicated regions would be junk, because they were hard to understand initially, and we hoped that we could just bypass them. But what happened is that as time went on, we realized that, in fact, they are the most gene-dense parts of the chromosome, and they contain all the genes that we as a lab are interested in, the genes for sperm production.
Steve Rosen is a researcher at the Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Research at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He co-directs several research projects on the Y chromosome, and he joined us today from the campus of MIT. Tom Klein, your thoughts on the Genome Project and this Y chromosome research in that context?
Well, in my peripheral way, I work on fruit flies, and I'm eagerly awaiting the sequencing of the fruit fly Y chromosome just to see what kind of general common principles really are shared between the fruit fly Y chromosome versus the human when there's about 400 or 500 million years distance between them and a totally different ancestry. That's the kind of thing that is comparing Y chromosomes between these organisms about which we know so much that really synergistically adds to our information. Unfortunately, another model system, the worm, doesn't have a Y, so we can't use that genome and that model system to learn about Y chromosomes. But certainly I hope we look at more Y chromosomes from a lot of organisms to really understand that. That's what will really tell us what's going on in depth. And
Tom Klein,
really wait that.
Tom Klein is a geneticist at the University of California, Berkeley. He researches sex determination, and he joined us from Berkeley today. Tom Klein and Steve Rosen, thank you both very much for joining me today.
Well, thank you very much.
It's been great.
Thanks also to everyone for listening and for calling. Odyssey's theme music was composed and performed by OK Go. Thanks to our research assistant, James Liris, and to our interns, Ragnar Anderson and Aruna Kilanani and Peter Bixler. Our technical producer is Steve Waranowskis. Our program is produced by Allison Cuddy and Delia Lloyd. The senior producer of Odyssey is Joshua Andrews. If you'd like to get in touch with us here, you can email us. Send your email to letters@odysseyradio.org. That's O-D-Y-S-S-E-Y radio, all one word, .org. Or mail us a letter to Odyssey, care of Chicago Public Radio, 848 East Grand Avenue, Chicago, Illinois, 60611. Odyssey is a production of Chicago Public Radio under general manager Tori Malatia. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Join us again next time for Odyssey.
Odyssey is marketed and distributed by Marge Ostruschko. Funding for the program is provided by a generous grant from the listeners of WBEZ Chicago, where Odyssey is produced. To listen again, visit our website, odysseyradio.org. You can find information there on how to order a copy of the show. That's odysseyradio.org.